Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us as we go into the second hour of the show. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Framus at the controls. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with a man who has quite a few years' experience in the field of nutrition, both for animals and for human beings. And his name is David Baker. He is an emeritus professor of animal sciences, nutritional sciences, and internal medicine here at the University of Illinois, and has been on the faculty since 1967. He got his PhD here in 1965. He has been a senior scientist at Eli Lilly and Company, and in his research, he's done work on animals that are raised for food and on companion animals and also on human beings. As I mentioned, he's received many awards for his work. He's going to be giving a talk on our Oh, I guess that already – did that already happen? No. It's next week, right? It's the week after that.
This week.
Tonight.
It's tonight. Okay. It's tonight on the U of I campus and talking a little bit about important things that we have learned in the field of nutrition and maybe also generally something about significant discoveries in science and how, I guess one of the things is how it is that sometimes you learn things, you discover things that weren't the things that you started out looking for. And I'm sure that there are a lot of good examples about the fact that it works that way sometimes in science. That is, some of the most interesting things are things that people kind of stumble over and then they look at it and say, well, that's pretty interesting. And then that takes you down a path that maybe you never thought that you would go down, but that ends up leading to significant discoveries. So we can perhaps talk a little bit about that, and maybe also talk about, generally speaking, about some of the significant things that we have learned about nutrition, about human nutrition. And questions are welcome. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Let me just – I want to make sure I get this straight now. Yes, this is indeed tonight at 7:30. This takes place in the auditorium at room 1404 of the Siebel Center on North Goodwin in Urbana, and this is the second Chancellor's CAS special lecture, which is in part sponsored by the Center for Advanced Study on the U of I campus. And all of these events, they're always open to the public and free. And so anybody who is interested in attending should feel welcome to stop by in the program. Well, again, I'm glad that you can be with us.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. Would it be, you know, sort of too general a question to ask about? So if I said, tell me the top five things, maybe the big five things that we have learned about human nutrition based on research in the last couple of decades. I mean, is there anything that just really stands out in your mind as you'd say, oh, yeah, no doubt about it? Some of the biggest stuff. Here are some of the biggest things that we have learned.
Well, in the last 10 to 20
years. It just sort of, yeah, in recent. Or, well, I don't, you know, maybe if you want to do the whole post-war.
Well, most of the major discoveries in nutrition occurred during the 20th century. You can start with the identification of the amino acids that are components of protein. We now know that there are 20 of these amino acids, and 10 are considered essential for maximal growth, and the other 10 can be synthesized. A lot of that work was done right here at the University of Illinois. In fact, W.C. Rose was the first person to coin the word essential versus non-essential amino acid, essential being that it must be present in the diet to achieve maximal growth. And Rose and his colleague Herb Carter were also the ones that discovered the last amino acid in 1935, namely threonine. But today we know that there's probably upwards of 25,000 different proteins floating around in our body at any one time. And it's rather amazing, to think that each one of those proteins has a specific genetic code for its synthesis, has a unique profile of amino acids, and are constantly turning over. Right now in our bodies, protein is being synthesized and broken down, which goes on constantly. So clearly in the area of protein, we've made major advances with the discovery of DNA by Watson and Crick allowed us to understand how protein is synthesized and the genetics of that whole thing. We've also learned that there are now 15 what we call essential mineral elements that must be present in the diet. And we pretty much know their functions, how they make enzymes work and things of that type. And we know also something that fascinates me, where I've worked quite a bit, and that is the extent or efficiency with which these mineral elements are absorbed. You have the extremes of elements like sodium and potassium and chloride and fluoride and iodide that are literally 100% absorbed from the GI tract into the bloodstream from a food matrix. Then you get down to iron and zinc, which there's only about 20% absorption. Of course, we need iron to get oxygen from the lungs to the cells, and we need zinc then to get the carbon dioxide, which is a waste product of cellular metabolism, back to the lungs so we can expire it. And only about 20% of zinc and iron from a food matrix are going to be absorbed from the GI tract. And you have an element like manganese, also essential. Only 5% of that is absorbed. And the least efficiently absorbed element that is essential is chromium. In the area of vitamins, we've discovered all the vitamins during the 20th century. We don't think there's any new vitamins yet to discover. We know that there's 4 that are fat-soluble or lipid-soluble and 10 that are water-soluble. And no fewer than 19 Nobel Prizes were awarded for the discovery of these vitamins in the 20th century because many of them caused terrible diseases like scurvy and rickets and night blindness.
Being deficient in those things.
Being deficient in those vitamins. And one of the keys to the discovery was developing animal models to test the efficacy of the vitamin itself. And I've done quite a bit of work with vitamins as well. We've also learned that there are 2 essential fatty acids. Yes, fat is required in our diet. We have to have those 2 essential fatty acids. But there's 3 for feline species, members of the cat family. They can't make arachidonic acid. And we've learned a lot about fiber, how it controls regularity and we know the components now of fiber. We've developed good analytical methods to measure fiber. And in the area of carbohydrates, and this has occurred rather recently, we now are using terminology like glycemic index. That is the extent to which a food increases blood glucose. And understanding the glycemic index of various foods helps us in the dietary control of things like diabetes and hyperlipidemia, and also in weight control. So we've made major advances in nutrition, clearly, in the 20th century. A couple of things I could mention that are, I'd say, hot topics today would include the research on selenium, which was one of the last mineral elements. It's an essential one. We required in very minute quantity, but it's a component of an enzyme, which was discovered in the 70s. And we now know that it has some rather marked beneficial effects against cancer of various kinds of cancer, not skin cancer, but colon cancer, breast cancer, and so forth. And that's a very hot topic as to, we know it's an antioxidant, but how exactly it works in preventing cancer is a very active area of research. I would also say that research in the area of carotenoids, the precursors of vitamin A, is very exciting because we now know that certain carotenoids may have beneficial effects in preventing macular degeneration and even cataracts. And so that's kind of a very interesting area. The area in the fat area, we've discovered a peculiar fatty acid called conjugated linoleic acid, better known as CLA, that seems to have some anti-cancer properties and may have some benefits in repartitioning body weight gain, more protein and less fat in the weight gain. So there's some hot topics out there right now.
Well, I tell you what, we have a caller here, somebody who has a question, and we'll give you an opportunity to talk with them and other people who are listening as well. You can call in 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The caller here is in Chicago. We'll go there on our toll-free line. Hello.
Hello, good morning. I have two questions. The first is about absorption of nutrients and medications. One of the medications for hypertension, or one type, is called a calcium channel blocker. And my question is, for someone in the elderly, especially with those with low bone density or possibly osteoporosis, would taking a hypertension medicine that's a calcium channel blocker prevent the absorption of calcium? And then the second question is about alpha-lipoic acid. I've been reading some stuff where that, the stuff I've read is only suggestive and there was nothing definite. I guess I'm asking if you know anything more definite. But that they seem to believe that that might be very good for people with metabolic syndrome, or what they call it, X syndrome. And so those are my two questions.
Yeah, I don't think that the calcium channel blockers in the anti-hypertension category are going to have much of an effect on calcium absorption. It's a different situation. In terms of alpha-lipoic acid, it's a very interesting. I could have used that as an example as a hot topic. It's just recently emerged. We know it's a potent antioxidant, and so if you're exposed to oxidants, as we all are, it could prevent damage to DNA and that type of thing. But that area of research is just emerging.
Okay, so the stuff that's just suggestive is just that. There's no definite proof that those who have the combination of diabetes and hypertension need to take that supplement.
No, I would say that I don't know of any definitive evidence in terms of diabetes, no.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the call. We have someone else here locally to talk with. It's line number one. Hello.
Hi. I'm curious about the effect or the need of silica in the diet. Is there any information with regard to the need for silica and how much, or if we need it at all? And I'll just hang up and listen on the radio.
All right.
Silicon is one of those ultra-trace elements that we know has a function in the body in very, very minute quantities. However, you could do an experiment with a completely chemically defined diet with no silicon at all in that diet, and you would see no effects at all. There's enough silica in contaminating the environment, in the air and so forth, that you're never going to see a deficiency of silica.
Well, I hope that gets to the question. Others are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL or 9455. Our guest for this hour of the program is David Baker. He is an emeritus professor of nutrition in the Department of Animal Sciences and Division of Nutritional Sciences at the University of Illinois, and has been involved in the field of nutrition research for both animals and human beings for quite a long time. He'll be giving a talk this evening at the auditorium at the Siebel Center, talking a little bit about some of the breakthroughs that have been achieved in nutrition in both animals and humans, and how sometimes it was the result of a happy accident, and other questions are welcome. You know, one of the things I think about is you talked about how we have gotten a pretty good understanding about what are the essential things that need to be in the diet for human beings for health. And we know that there are the vitamins, and we have some idea how much is optimum. And then we have these other things, these trace minerals that you need to have. Maybe you don't need to have a lot of them, but you need mm-hmm. to have them there. And we have a pretty good idea about how this works. And certainly, I'm sure any nutritionist would say to you, what we would really like for you to do is to have a healthy, well-balanced diet and for you to get all of these by eating good food. At the same time, we say, not everybody does that for one reason or another. So we have ways to supplement all of these things, which also then opens up the possibility of getting overly fixated on something and overdoing that particular thing. Mm-hmm. And certainly we know that some things, for example, there are some vitamins that you need to have them and you need to have a certain amount of them in your diet, but they're potentially toxic if you take too much, particularly those that are fat soluble. They can build up to toxic levels in the body if you have too much. So I guess I'm wondering whether, and particularly because nutrition gets so much attention in the media, whether in fact you think sometimes we end up fixating on one thing in particular and then maybe overdoing that because someone comes along and says, well, we got a thing here that's just the key to health. And if you just have just take a whole bunch of this, fill in the blank thing, you won't get cancer or you'll live forever. Or you mm-hmm. won't get heart disease or whatever. I mean, do we lose a sense of that it's everything is sort of a total package and it's all supposed to be kind of in balance?
Yeah, I think you've hit upon something that is really quite important. Clearly, if we all ate a diverse and balanced diet, we wouldn't need to take supplements. I mean, there's no mm-hmm. question about that. The other thing I should mention is that you can buy things over the counter in health food stores and pharmacies and even supermarkets that there's really very little regulation of this. And some of the substances that are available are potentially toxic. There's probably not a lot of good efficacy data. There's not a lot of good chronic or acute toxicity data. And those of us that are professional nutritionists are somewhat concerned about this. I mean, I used the example of selenium. Selenium is an element that at high doses can be very, very toxic. And the studies that have been done in cancer prevention, they use 200 microgram tablets. 1 microgram is so small you can't see it. In fact, you can't see a milligram, which is 1,000 times bigger. But the problem is that some people don't read the labels properly and they think, well, if one pill is good, maybe 10 is better, and they could get themselves in a lot of trouble.
Yeah. Well, having said that, though, it is true that now we have, I guess I would say it's an emerging field. Maybe it's been emerging for a while that we call functional. We talk about functional foods.
Mm-hmm.
And I know some people laugh and say, well, I know what the function of food is. It's to keep you alive. But the fact is that we, are getting a greater appreciation that there may be certain things in food that are important preventive agents, and that by maybe increasing certain sorts of things that we could say to people that we could lower your risk of heart disease. We could lower your risk of cancer, maybe other things as well, and so that might indeed lead you to think, well, possibly by eating more of certain things, or if you can't do that, then supplementing certain things, there might actually be health benefits, and that we would get to the point where you'd actually get a prescription for, either here's my prescription, eat lots of broccoli, mm-hmm. or here's a pill. Mm-hmm. And include this, in your diet every day. I mean, are we getting to the point where we're going to be using, maybe thinking about food more in that way?
Yeah, I think so. I think this is a big area, functional foods, and we now have the ability to genetically alter plants and even animals to produce food products that have a different profile, maybe a healthier profile. The three nutrients that are probably most deficient worldwide are vitamin A, iron, and the amino acid lysine, which is caused by eating very poor quality proteins. No meat, milk, and eggs, just eating grain products and that type of thing. probably the thing that's furthest along is producing crops. This is mainly pertinent for the underdeveloped world, the underdeveloped countries that have higher vitamin A. And we now have golden rice, where they have genetically altered the rice plant to have more, which normally has very little vitamin A activity, to have substantially more vitamin A. And it's had a dramatic effect in the underdeveloped countries to prevent everything from macular degeneration, or minimize it at least, to night blindness and other symptoms of vitamin A deficiency. Mm-hmm. But yes, we're interested in components of plants that we weren't interested in 20 years ago that may have beneficial effects. Now, I would say a word of caution that the scientific jury is probably still out in terms of your question as whether we have really definitive data in terms of whether a mega dose of whatever nutrient we're talking about is going to minimize or prevent cancer or diabetes or heart disease.
Yeah. Well, just I have now several calls. I promise those folks we'll get right to them. But your comment invites the question, if you say that worldwide,
right,
the big, if we look at deficiency in diet, the big three things would be vitamin A, iron, and the amino acid lysine. My guess would be if you look at the average American diet, I wouldn't think that would be particularly deficient in those things. Now, you know, maybe I'm wrong. I mean, do you actually see a vitamin A deficiency and people not getting enough iron and not having enough lysine, say, in your average American's diet?
It's far lower, but you do see vitamin A deficiency in people that are on poor diets in the United States, and you know, iron deficiency anemia is still a problem in segments of the U.S. population. Not nearly the problem it would be in African countries or that type of thing.
Okay, and it seems by the same token, there are certain things that probably we have too much of in the American diet.
Oh yes, I mean those of us in the affluent category probably you know, we eat twice as much protein as we need, you know, and that type of thing. Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's talk with some other people who are listening. We have next someone in Champaign. They're the next in line, and that would be line number one.
Oh, hello.
Yes.
This is probably a naive question, but, you know, I'm wondering, what is a vitamin, and how do they put it in a pill, and I mean, is it a thing? Is it? I just have never known what it was.
Well, the definition of a vitamin is a trace organic nutrient. They're all organic compounds. The level required is exceedingly small. The two vitamins required in lowest quantity are vitamin D and vitamin B12. And the daily amount you need is so small you couldn't see it if I put it right in front of you. But what vitamins do is make enzymatic reactions work in the body. Vitamins themselves do not really provide energy, but they facilitate energy production and protein synthesis and carbohydrate metabolism. So we need them to metabolize the energy-furnishing nutrients like fat, protein, and carbohydrates.
I see.
Okay. Does that answer your question? You want to ask more questions?
Partly, I'm trying to think. Is it like I'm trying to visualize it? You know.
Through scientific achievements in the 20th century, we found a way to make all these vitamins in the laboratory, pure chemical forms of the vitamins, and there's some misguided ideas out there that a natural vitamin, for example, rose hips vitamin C, is better than pure crystalline vitamin C, which is not true.
Oh.
But some people believe it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, thank you.
Okay. So these things, vitamins as well as the minerals, are naturally present. They naturally occur in the food that we eat. So those things are in there already, I suppose, in varying amounts in different,
right,
different sorts of foods.
So certain components of foods can make especially the minerals, either better or more poorly utilize. For example, spinach and rhubarb are relatively good sources of calcium, but these products have oxalic acid, which binds the calcium and you can't absorb it. In fact, people that do not eat dairy products, which is the main source of calcium in our diet, have trouble meeting their calcium requirement, and they need to be thinking about maybe taking a calcium supplement, either fortified orange juice or a calcium pill.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested. You talked about the fact that we're talking about vitamin D, for example, that of all of the vitamins, if you look at the RDA, that's one of the smallest ones, right? I'm thinking about the fact that having said that, though, that here on the program, for example, frequently I have conversations with a physician who is an OBGYN, and she has talked maybe within the last year or so a couple of times about studies that now show that there is actually, and here in the United States, there's actually fairly significantly high levels of vitamin D deficiency. That is, that people are not getting enough, and that it's important for absorption, to have it for absorption of calcium.
Well, it is. And I think we've gone overboard and talked. You mentioned earlier about potential toxicity. Yeah. And we've worried about vitamin D as being one of the more toxic vitamins. And as a result, we've tried to, and our worries about skin cancer, because we make vitamin D in our skin by the action of ultraviolet light So, yeah, the current thinking is maybe we're not getting enough vitamin D. We need vitamin D to absorb not only calcium but phosphorus.
Yeah. Let's go to another caller, and I think this will be someone in Urbana, line number 3. Hello. Is there a caller there, line 3?
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Yes. I have a question about calcium. Particularly for older men, I know the requirement is less than for women, but some of the research is confusing as to whether it should be 1,200 milligrams or less, and some people are concerned that a higher dose of calcium might promote prostate cancer. What would be an appropriate level of calcium?
Well, I think anywhere from it's dependent on the kind of diet that a person is on. You know, if you're avoiding dairy products, for example, I think you probably should be taking 1,200 to 1,500 milligrams a day. You know, people that tend to go overboard and take, say, 3,000 milligrams or just 3 grams a day, I don't believe there's solid evidence in terms of a link to prostate cancer. However, when you take those high levels of calcium, it can cause problems with zinc, for example, because calcium is involved in a process that can make zinc less absorbable from the GI tract.
And one other question about oxalic acid. Now, I know spinach contains oxalic acid, and it does interfere with the absorption of calcium. Now, is that a long-term effect, or would that be should a person avoid spinach maybe on a daily basis one day and then still continue to use spinach periodically?
Yeah, no, I think spinach is a good vegetable. I don't mean to imply that people shouldn't eat spinach because of oxalic acid. It's just that you need to recognize that the analyzed amount of calcium in spinach is not going to be there for absorption. It's not a long-term effect.
No long-term.
No.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. And we'll continue here. I believe the next caller would be Urbana in line number 2. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Two things. One, there was a I was going to get your reaction to a news item on ABC News earlier this month, which reported that Donald Davis, biochemist at the University of Texas at Austin, had put out a news release saying that fruits and veggies are not as vitamin-rich as in the past, that recently grown crops have shown decreases of up to 38% in protein, calcium, vitamin C, phosphorus, iron, and riboflavin, and he call this the dilution effect, because what happens is when they attempt to make higher yields, they automatically lower the nutrients. I wanted to get your comment on that before. I've got a question, too.
Yeah, that's a very interesting question, and one that actually we can answer, I think. I haven't seen the article in that you refer to from the University of Texas at Austin. However, as you may know, we have the Morro plots at the University of Illinois, where corn has been grown constantly over, you know, 120, 130 years. And I've been involved in a project where we're analyzing the nutrients in that corn that has either been fertilized, high-yield corn, low-yield corn, and what was the difference in the yield from corn produced in 1920 versus the year 2000. And at least, and we've looked at riboflavin. You mentioned riboflavin and folic acid, another vitamin, and we've looked at some of the amino acids, and we don't see really the kind of link that you're mentioning. I think there's been concern out there that that we're increasing yields to such an extent that we're lowering nutrient content. Our research at the University of Illinois would suggest that that's just not the case.
Hmm. Well, that's interesting. He supposedly was using data from the Department of Agriculture, and but anyway, I guess I'll have to say that that's a contentious issue.
Sounds like it.
The and the other thing was that on the on WILL TV recently, during one of the fund drives, they had this fellow on called Pericone, I believe his name was, and I don't know if you happen to see that.
I did not.
Ah, okay. Well, because he mentioned some nutrients and vitamins that people should be looking to if they, you know, want to stay slim and live a long time. And you already mentioned three of them: conjugated linoleic acid, chromium, and ethylapoic acid. But I was wondering if you had anything to say about some of the others, like glutamine, carnitine, acetyl L-carnitine, CoQ10.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you really shouldn't need carnitine. See, I'm trying to remember the other one you mentioned.
Acetyl L, carnitine, CoQ10, glutamine.
Yeah, glutamine, you know, your diet, if you eat a reasonable amount of protein, you're getting all kinds of glutamine, and you can produce it in the body as well. So I there's certain, you know, disease situations where glutamine has shown efficacy, but in a normal person on a normal diet, I see no basis for needing supplemental glutamine. And I know some people are taking coenzyme Q10. And again, if you're on a balanced diet, I'm not sure that you really need that. There's some hearsay out there. I'd say the jury is still out on that.
How about carnitine?
Carnitine, we also synthesize in our body. The amino acids lysine and methionine are involved. And we shouldn't need to take supplemental carnitine. We should be able to make it easily in our body.
Hmm. All right, thank you.
All right, thanks. You know, this question gets at something that I have been thinking about here, and maybe you can talk a little bit about the fact that now nutrition and nutrition research gets a tremendous amount of coverage in popular media, in print and in broadcast. There's all kinds of stuff about what we should be eating, a relationship between diet and health. And there are, I'm sure, a lot of different people who have different ideas and who would urge a particular kind of diet. There might be something in, as we talked about, there might be one thing or a handful of things they say, here are these things, I think you should get more of this, and maybe you don't get it in your diet, so, you know, here I have a supplement for that. And I'm sure that for a lot of people, it is extremely confusing if they're trying to figure out, you know, what constitutes a healthy diet, and particularly if there's anything that would be worth supplementing. And I'm sure people are frustrated because they have this perception. I don't know if it's true, but they have this perception as well. You know how these scientists are. 1 week they're telling us one thing, and then a couple of weeks later they've turned around and they're telling us something else. So, you know, all of that. I guess I'm interested in your thoughts about, particularly about how nutritional issues get reported in popular media.
Well, I think one of the big problems is, and I think my colleagues would agree with me, those of us that have spent our life in nutrition and metabolism would say a lot of the advice that's being given is not being given by experts. Because there's a lot of people that pick up on it because there's money to be made. Books are written on how to lose weight and what you need to take and how to prevent this or prevent that. And unfortunately, scientists usually are not asked. This guest appearance here is not something that happens every day. So I think a lot of the advice being given is being given by people that probably have questionable qualifications.
Having said that, then if someone's saying to you, where would be a good place for me to go to get good basic sort of mainstream advice on what constitutes a healthy diet, so I can think about am I eating in a healthy way?
Okay, we have one of the most impressive nutrition groups in the world right here at the University of Illinois in several departments. We have an extension service in the Department of Food Science and Human Nutrition with extension specialists. And if you want good information about the questions you're asking, that's where to go. Mm-hmm. Okay? They interact with all of us, and they try to make it practical. And, that's where the information should be sought.
All right. Well, we have about 15 minutes left in this part of the show. We certainly have time for other questions, and I probably should introduce again our guest, David Baker. He's been a member of the faculty of University of Illinois since 1967. He got his Ph.D. here, and at the moment he holds emeritus appointments in animal sciences, nutritional sciences, and internal medicine, and over the years has done a lot of research work on animals raised for food and companion animals and also human beings and the relationship between diet and health. And he's going to give a talk talking about some of the breakthroughs in nutrition of both animals and humans. This is the second Chancellor's CAS special lecture. So the Center for Advanced Study is involved in sponsoring this event. That's tonight, 7:30. At the auditorium in the Siebel Center on North Goodwin in Urbana. And anyone interested in attending should feel welcome. We have some other callers here. We'll try to get to them and go next to line number one, I believe, and that would be Champagne. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. I have a question for Dr. Baker. How important do you feel that the animal is a model for human research? When you're doing your nutritional studies, do you feel that animals are very, with all this expansion of the South Farms going on, do you feel that it's, what's your feelings on the need for animals in order to do human nutrition research studies?
I think animal models are absolutely essential because when you discover something, you can't immediately go into humans. You have to test it with an animal model. And it was one of the things that allowed us to make the discoveries we did with vitamins. I've used the chick a lot in my studies because the chick is a wonderful animal model in many respects and for certain nutrients better than the rat, which is used often more frequently. So clearly animal models, whether it be the pig, the chick, the rat, the mouse, or whatever, are very, very important in biological research.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. We'll go to Vermilion County. This is line number four. Hello.
Hi. I want to ask about calcium in terms of practical application. Not everyone is on a municipal water supply, and so those of us who drink well water have a lot of calcium in our water already. And I realize that there are calcium-fortified orange juices, and they sometimes talk about calcium citrate versus calcium carbonate. I think well water calcium is calcium carbonate. Is that correct?
There would be calcium carbonate and also oxide as well.
So as far as applying the idea of getting enough calcium to a diet that's maybe a couple of glasses, two or three glasses of dairy like milk, and the rest of the 8 glasses or more of fluid come from hard water. What's a practical way of deciding whether to take supplements and how much?
Well, I think you're getting at a really important question, and that is, are all forms of calcium, and that's true for other nutrients, are all forms of nutrients the same?
And absorbable.
In terms of their ability to be absorbed from the GI tract into the bloodstream, we've actually worked on this with animal models, and there's been direct evidence in humans as well. And actually, calcium carbonate, whether it's oyster shell or calcium carbonate made chemically, is absorbed. The calcium's absorbed about the same extent as calcium citrate or calcium citrate malate. Some people think maybe you can assimilate it and have fewer GI-type problems or heartburn with the citrate form of calcium or the citrate malate form. But your question about the calcium in hard water, I'm not sure I've seen studies on that. That's an interesting question. I think one would need to look at the form of calcium, how much is there, and whether, in fact, it can be solubilized and absorbed from the GI tract. In general, I would say if you asked our extension service, they would say don't rely on well water as a source of calcium.
So that would presume that it's not the calcium's not absorbable?
That would be the presumption, but I'm not sure that I've seen studies. I don't know how much calcium you're talking about. Have you had your water analyzed?
No, I just know that every time I boil anything, I get a ring of, you know, the calcium salt just there. If you let a glass of water sit,
right,
it makes a, crystals or whatever you call it on the bottom of the glass.
Right, right. Well, I think maybe work is needed in that area. It's a very good question you raise, and I'm not sure I can answer it.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks. Let's go to line 3. That would be Urbana. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I don't know if this is a nutrition question, but when you were asking or talking about vitamin A, I've always wondered about Accutane, and I understand Accutane is just a massive dose of vitamin A. Is that right?
It's a certain form of vitamin A, yeah.
Yeah.
It's an acid form.
If a young person takes that,
you mean orally, or you put it on your skin?
This would be an oral dose.
Uh-huh.
When they're treating acne.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a long term effect? I get some, on the web. There's messages and things that fly around, and who knows where they come from. But there was some warning about, oh, people who use Accutane, they're going to have all these, from pancreas failure to whatever. And it made me wonder, is there long-term effects of people who actually take Accutane? And I don't know if you are qualified to talk about that, but I wondered if you had any thoughts.
Yeah, I don't feel qualified to talk about Accutane per se, but I can tell you that any source of vitamin A, you want to be careful about how much you take, because even at 10 times the minimum daily adult requirement, some people will experience toxicity. So it's not one of those nutrients or vitamins that you would want to take a lot of.
Uh-huh. And when somebody gets toxic dose, what kind of symptoms or what happens to them?
Well, I think you have liver problems and other types of things that I'm not really a vitamin A expert, but
mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I'll just keep looking around. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Well, I think that's one of the reasons there for people who are taking Accutane for acne. One of the things that they do is they do regular screenings of them to check to make sure that there aren't any liver problems as through the course of the medication. And I think it's generally taken over a period of about 3 months, mm-hmm. something like that.
Yeah. 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 The liver is where vitamin A is stored. And so that's mm-hmm. that would be a target tissue to look at.
Okay. Well, let's continue. The next caller should be line number 2 in Urbana. Hello.
I just wanted to add to your comments about some people talking, pretending they're experts when they're not. There was a recent article. It was either in Consumer Reports on Health or Nutrition Action, which is from the Center for Science and the Public Interest. And they were explaining that there were problems with Dr. Andrew Weil, who is claims to be a nutrition expert, having an interest in vitamins and supplements that he himself was selling, and backing it up with supposedly with inconsistent and bogus information. They also cited Dr. Phil, who is a
psychologist
who's now touting diet and nutritional stuff and gaining from his books and the supplements that he sells. And, I mean, he's less obviously a nutritionist, but some people see doctor and they think, okay. It's like Dr. Lohr, who only has a degree in was it physical education or something like this, and she pretends to be a psychiatrist or a psychologist. And then also, descending even further was, he has a talk show. Anyway, he has totally no background in any of this at all. So we really have to be careful that not only may people not know what they're talking about, but they may seem like they should and have a financial interest in things that they are pushing. And so we need to keep our eyes open. And I was particularly bothered by Dr. Andrew Wiles.
Yeah, very, very well said. I've been on committees. We've been very concerned about the amount of nutrition education and information that our MD colleagues have, because there's just not enough time in medical school for them to be taking courses in nutrition. And in some cases, MDs, internal medicine people, general practitioners, have had no course in nutrition, and yet the general public expects them to answer their questions about nutrition. And many times they're just not well enough informed to do that.
Oh, it was Larry King who was the talk show host. He was promoting coral calcium, and he's had a whole series of things that are bogus. And I really do recommend those two newsletters. I know that there are other medical ones, but there's only so much I can absorb. But they do both analyze whatever the recent medical information is on something and go into it in depth, but in a way that the layperson can understand.
Right.
Thanks.
All right, thank you. Let's go to a cell phone caller here, line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I was curious. I appreciated your endorsement of the U of I nutrition faculty and the extension service, but in terms of a compendium, a sort of general handbook for nutrition, is there something that is readily available, something such as the works of Andrew Weil or someone else that you would say would be solid and reliable?
Yeah, there's several excellent introductory textbooks in nutrition that are used, in fact, in teaching at the University of Illinois. And I've looked at these, even though I don't teach introductory courses. They're excellent books, and more importantly, they're authored by people that have PhDs in nutrition and know what they're talking about.
You want to mention any titles in particular?
I'm struggling to think of the exact title. I think there's one, Principles of Nutrition. I don't remember the authors. I have copies at home. But I'm sure that a call to the Extension Service, they could come up with those books very easily.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. We see we try one more. We have a caller in Burlington, Illinois, line four. Hello.
Yes, hi. Mm-hmm. Is there any evidence that products with plant sterols can lower cholesterol?
There is. I'm trying to think of the compound phytosterol or something like that that has some cholesterol lowering effects, but not just any sterol can do that.
Mm-hmm. Some of them advertise that they have phytosterol.
Yeah.
Is that the word you're thinking of?
Yeah. And I think some of that is probably hyperbole, but the nutrient that is used clinically, of course, to lower cholesterol at about 200 times the requirement, incidentally, is the vitamin niacin.
Uh-huh.
But the side effect of taking 200 milligrams per kilogram of niacin is that you get a flushing effect. Your face feels flushed and that type of thing. But it will lower cholesterol, not as effectively as the statin drugs, but it'll lower it maybe 15%.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks. We're just about the point where we're going to have to finish. Just real quick, we talked earlier about the fact that that science, basically in the 20th century, identified the essential building blocks that bodies need and should be in diet. And probably for a long time, those things have been packaged in supplement form. So you can go down and you can buy a multivitamin mineral that seems to be what mainstream nutritional advice said, here's what you should need. And I'm wondering if you think what sort of thing – well, for example, now some of those supplements are packaged with lycopene, which is a relatively recent sort of an addition to the list. Do you think that sometime here in the near future there might be something else that might be added to that list that we would say, yeah, you should be able to get this in your diet, but if you're not, okay, we'll put that in there with the mix, with this basic package of stuff we think it would be good for you to have.
Yeah, and that's happening all the time, I think. If you look at infant formulas, they're now being fortified with taurine and carnitine and nucleotides and things like that. But clearly, we're going to see more of that. One of the things that came up was alpha-lipoic acid. The jury is still out on this, but it definitely does have antioxidant activity. You mentioned lycopene. The data on lycopene and prostate cancer is still emerging. It's not a definite link. Probably even more exciting to me is lutein, and that's another carotenoid, and that seems to have beneficial effects in preventing both cataracts and macular degeneration.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we'll leave it there for now with the promise that we'll see in our future programs we can give you more opportunity to ask questions like this. And, of course, on the Afternoon Magazine, every month we have a nutritionist on to answer these sorts of questions. And if you're interested, you're in and around Champaign-Urbana, our guest, David Baker, will be talking about breakthroughs in nutrition in both animals and humans and about how sometimes happy accidents lead you to learned things that you didn't already know. That's tonight, 7:30, at the auditorium at the Siebel Center on North Goodwin in Urbana. This is the second Chancellor's CAS special lecture, and anybody's welcome to attend. And thank you very much.
You're welcome.